It's hard to find the time to read all of the best articles on Bitcoin and the crypto economy. So let me read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. Welcome back to the Crypto Economy. We are going to be finishing out for the end of this week, Sovereignty Through Mathematics by Knut Svanholm, we will be starting with chapter 11 and cruising right to the end here. I am Guy Swan, your host, but this is part 5, the final part of an audiobook. So again, just as a precursor, make sure you go back and listen to them, or this is not going to make a whole lot of sense. But with that, let's go ahead and just jump right into this. We are on chapter 11, A New Form of Life. It's not easy to define the properties that would deem an entity a new form of life. There's no consensus among scientists nor nations regarding the definition of what a life form is. This is one of the main hurdles when it comes to defining artificial or synthetic life. How does one know when life has been created, if there's no clear definition of what life actually is? One popular definition of life is that a living organism is an open system that maintains homeostasis, is composed of cells, has a life cycle, undergoes metabolism, can grow, adapt to its environment, respond to stimuli, reproduce, and evolve. Could Bitcoin fit into this description? In order to find out, we need to dissect both this definition of life and the basic properties of the Bitcoin network. Bitcoin is quite clearly an open system, but what does it mean for an organism to, quote, maintain homeostasis? Homeostasis is the tendency towards a relatively stable equilibrium between interdependent elements, especially, but not limited to, as maintained by psychological processes. The first part of that sentence perfectly describes what Bitcoin does. The equilibrium is the consensus between the nodes, which act as interdependent elements. One can even argue that they actually are maintained by psychological processes, since each node's decisions are ultimately made by human brains and not software. But for now, we'll examine Bitcoin as a life form from a non-meta argument perspective. The next part of the definition is that life is made up of cells, which the Bitcoin network also arguably is, especially if you count nodes as cells. A life cycle is defined as a, quote, series of changes in form that an organism undergoes, returning to the starting state, end quote, according to Wikipedia. The life cycle of the Bitcoin network is still unclear, but it seems unlikely that it would ever return to its starting state. What is more likely is that while we have witnessed its birth, it is highly unlikely that any human alive today will outlive the network, so we won't have any way of knowing. This is not unheard of in nature either, however. A species of fungi called Armillaria astoia, or the humongous fungus, in the Blue Mountains of Oregon, is one of the largest and oldest organisms ever known to man. This network of mushroom is estimated to be between 2,500 and 8,500 years old, based on its current growth rate. No one knows what its life cycle looks like in perfect detail. The three main purposes of metabolism in a living body are the conversion of food to energy to run cellular processes, the conversion of food into bodily building blocks, and the elimination of nitrogenous waste. Bitcoin's metabolism works in a similar manner. Bitcoin feeds on electricity, and its cellular processes are its transactions. Its body has its own building blocks, literal blocks, that are added to its body, the blockchain, roughly every 10 minutes. Malicious blocks are considered waste and are thus eliminated by the system. Bitcoin grows and adapts to its environment organically. exemplified lately by the development of the Lightning Network and other Layer 2 scaling solutions. It responds to external stimuli by showing a more and more ironclad resistance to change, while still responding well to sufficiently clever improvement proposals. Like the Armillaria Astoia, Bitcoin rather grows than reproduces, and it evolves over time by adopting good ideas and rejecting bad ones. The notion of Bitcoin as a life form may sound far-fetched and even a bit silly, even though a lot of its properties fit the bill. What we do know about it is that it is very unlikely to go away or stop functioning for any foreseeable future. Whether or not it lives is up for debate, but it can't be killed, and that ought to mean something. We should study it carefully and try to be as unbiased and humble as possible when drawing conclusions about it. Speaking of fungi, one of the most important aspects of money is its fungibility. Fungibility goes hand in hand with privacy and censorship resistance. If certain Bitcoin addresses were to end up on a government's blacklist, they'd end up becoming less valuable than their not-yet-blacklisted neighbors. Look at what happened to the Indian rupee bills that were banned overnight by the Indian government in late 2017 in order to, quote, fight corruption. They're still in use, but only worth about 70% of the value they held when they were considered, quote, legal tender. If Bitcoin transactions can't be private, they won't be fungible. This reduces Bitcoin's monetary capability. We're at a point in history where Bitcoin transactions can be completely private, but only a select few people know how to ensure that they really are. This is arguably Bitcoin's greatest flaw and a very real hurdle on the way to mainstream adoption. So how many privacy measures does the average user need to take? Just as when it comes to storage, it depends on the user's knowledge level. Most users should probably be more careful than they are right now, but there's little reason to be paranoid. It's still very hard to prove that a specific transaction was made by a specific user. The whole ordeal is somewhat akin to the fight against the BitTorrent network 10 years ago. The copyright lobby found different means of scaring off users in different parts of the world, banning websites, prosecuting providers, and so on. But the network itself is still thriving, and torrent files are as accessible as they ever were. A lot of heads will probably have to roll before Bitcoin is accepted everywhere, but just like they couldn't fight file sharing, governments won't be able to fight Bitcoin. Even the policymakers will understand the advantages of Bitcoin usage sooner or later. The word later is key here. If you want to be absolutely sure that what you do with your Bitcoin is legal, private, or worthwhile, just wait. Wait out the storm and don't use them until they're fully acceptable everywhere. They'll be worth a lot more and you'll have a lot more options in general. Remember, hodling is using. One of the greatest hidden perks of Bitcoin adoption is that it forces people to think for themselves. First, it forces the user to think about computer security. In order to store your Bitcoin safely, you have to know what you're doing, what software and hardware you can trust, etc. It is virtually impossible to do anything online without trusting any third party. Every piece of hardware and software inside and in between each of the two computers communicating could potentially be corrupt. In Bitcoin, the cautious user will be rewarded and the reckless user will be punished eventually. This is also true for Bitcoin's on and off ramps, and the less cautious user is always more likely to end up in legal trouble. The coming tsunami that is hyper-Bitcoinization is scary, but a skilled surfer can expect the ride of a lifetime. Chapter 12, The Years Ahead. The Lindy Effect is a theory that describes the future life expectancy of a technology or an idea. It states that an idea's expected remaining lifespan is proportional to its current age, so that every additional period of survival implies a longer remaining life expectancy. Bitcoin, which is not only an idea, but also a technology and a social experiment, is 10 years old now, and therefore we can expect it to stay around for at least another 10. At the time of writing, there are exactly 17,669,941 Bitcoins around, and 12.5 new ones are created every 10 minutes. 17,669,941 is about 84% of the total supply. In other words, the total number of Bitcoins that will ever exist. 10 years from now, around 20 million Bitcoins will have been found. 3 more block reward halvings will have taken place, and the reward for each block found will be 1.5625 Bitcoins. The whole world will have a little more than 2.5 million new Bitcoins around. This is to be compared with more than 17.5 million that was created during the last 10 years, when they were cheap and relatively easy to come by. In the network's first couple of years, you could acquire several Bitcoins by just claiming them from special websites called faucets every once in a while. The dollar's cumulative rate of inflation was 15.6% during this period. This means that each dollar lost more than 1/6 of its value in the last 10 years due to quantitative easing, which is the central banker's term for counterfeiting. It is very unlikely that the cumulative rate of inflation for the US dollar in the upcoming 10 years will be any lower than this 15.6%, since the fractional reserve lending system requires a little more inflation each year to sustain itself. So a little less than 2.5 million new Bitcoins to share, and at least 20% more US dollars in circulation to buy them with. Now, let's look at the internet itself. Metcalfe's law states that the value of a communications network is proportional to the amount of users on the network squared. Each new internet user is a potential new Bitcoin user, especially in those places on the planet where there's poor internet connectivity, because those places often have a weak local currency that Bitcoin functions as a hedge against. In 2008, 23% of the world's population had access to the internet, and in 2018, that number was 48%. In the developing world, the numbers were 14% in 2008, and 41% in 2018. The global numbers might not double again in the forthcoming 10 years, but it looks like they'll keep on rising, especially in the developing countries, where they might just double again. All of these indicators, fewer bitcoins, more fiat money, more internet users, point toward a rising Bitcoin price, regardless of its current valuation. Bitcoin has risen in value extremely fast and has added, on average, an additional zero at the end of its price figure roughly every 3 years. Can it really keep on doing so? Think about the underlying forces that drive the price up. Every single mobile device could potentially hold Bitcoins, yet only a select few do. When more and more people embrace the technology, the whole fear of missing out cycle starts again, and the price jumps up to the next plateau. Note also that every current Bitcoin user can do 3 things with his or her Bitcoins: sell them, lose them, or hold them. On top of this, nothing is stopping an existing Bitcoin user from acquiring new Bitcoin. Bitcoin is an internet protocol that is very resistant to change. It showed an unprecedented example of this in late 2017, when all of the biggest companies in Bitcoin decided that they were going to implement the proposed segregated witness upgrade and then hard fork to 2 megabyte blocks a couple of months later. Segregated witness, which most users wanted, was activated, but the network's users resisted the 2 megabyte block hard fork. This led to a lot of frustration among the proponents of the hard fork, and led to the creation of a copycat altcoin called Bitcoin Cash. The price of both tokens rose quickly in the aftermath of the fork, but in hindsight, the event was more of a train robbery than a Christmas gift, confusing at best. Segregated witness does not only free up block space, but it also allows for layer 2 scaling solutions to be built on top of Bitcoin, such as the Lightning Network. The Lightning Network allows for instant, completely anonymous, nearly free microtransactions that do not take up block space, and it is up and running right now. In addition to this, the number of Lightning Network transactions that can be carried out simultaneously are only limited by the bandwidth of the nodes. This makes the Lightning Network a future real competitor to Visa or MasterCard. Many other Layer 2 upgrades are in the works, but the core Bitcoin network functions the same way it always has, with its inputs and outputs, its public and private keys, and so on. Will some other token ever replace Bitcoin then? After all, more efficient protocols are out there. Short answer, no. This has been mentioned several times before in this book, but it can't be stressed enough. Scarcity on the internet was a one-time discovery. It was a one-time invention, and it cannot be repeated because resistance to replicability is the invention. Bitcoin's history and unique position is what makes it truly scarce and resistant to change, and these first 10 years will not repeat themselves for any, quote, alternative token. There is still a lot of confusion about what Bitcoin is, and the idea of sound money on the internet is a hard concept to grasp, since humans haven't ever encountered absolute scarcity before. The best path forward for any person is arguably to educate him or herself and others about the invention and what it means. Time will tell whether your sources were true or false, and it is unlikely that Bitcoin will achieve mass adoption in the next couple of years. Still, the infrastructure is in place, and the interfaces of its surrounding software, like wallets, are getting more and more user-friendly every day. Remember, the iPhone was first introduced to the world in 2007, and smartphones had enormous corporate marketing to help them succeed all along the way. Bitcoin grows organically. Let it breathe and watch it evolve. But whatever you do, don't miss the opportunity and acquire some while you still can at this discounted price. Afterthought. I hope you've learned something from reading this book, and I encourage every reader to fact-check me and challenge my opinions. Ideas left unchallenged seldom age well. All opinions, political or not, expressed in the book are first and foremost meant to be thought-provoking and are not meant to be taken too literally. Finally, I recommend reading some of the old Ludwig von Mises, Human Action, for instance, perhaps while listening to some of the old Ludwig von Beethoven, the third movement of the Moonlight Sonata, for instance. I hope you have enjoyed this reading of Knut Svanholm's Sovereignty Through Mathematics. Let's hit our sponsor real quick, and we'll go over some commentary on this last section before we close out our week. So anybody who has listened to this show knows that I love diving into the concept of Bitcoin as an organism. And there's a couple of things that he actually points out in this one that I feel like I've probably talked about, but maybe when I read it here, it really kind of hit a little bit harder. When I heard him explain it, was that about the life cycle thing is that we don't really, like, we kind of refer to that as a very important part of what we think of as living organisms, but there's no argument that fungi are alive. And yet, you know, we're talking about, you know, a network of fungi that is, you know, arguably thousands and thousands of years old. So what is the importance of that life cycle? Like, is there really a life cycle? Because it is not like reproducing in the normal sense. It is simply growing and expanding and evolving by taking in other processes from its environment and responding to its environment and changing in order to survive longer and better. Fungi is a just fascinating thing. And really, what's funny is that Bitcoin got me down the road of just kind of learning about fungi. The Paul Stamets has a lot of great stuff, and obviously Brandon Quidham and Der Gigi, all of these are great for a number of different on pieces on the fascinating nature of fungi, and then obviously the many corollaries and analogies to the Bitcoin system. And there's actually one post or one part of this book which I heard a very different. I'll see if I can't. I'm gonna actually find it real quick so I can actually read it on the show, because this is a really interesting analogy for this concept. And I'll start off by actually reading the quote from Sovereignty Through Mathematics that we just went through, that leads me to think this might actually be the wrong way to conceptualize it. So it's talking about Bitcoin's metabolism works in a similar manner. Bitcoin feeds on electricity, and its cellular processes are its transactions. Its body has its own building blocks, literal blocks that are added to its body, the blockchain, roughly every 10 minutes. Malicious blocks are considered waste and are thus eliminated by the system. So let me read you the tweet or the Twitter thread here that I think has a very interesting new way of thinking about what the blockchain is rather than Bitcoin's body. So the thread was by Udi Wertheimer. Wertheimer? I have no idea how to say his name. I'm sure everybody knows him from Twitter. I'll link to this thread in the show notes along with everything else. But it just starts. We'll just jump right into the thread. Reminder: the blockchain is the undesirable waste that is produced during the useful process of transferring bitcoins. It never ceases to amaze me how we continue to promote the positive, almost magical uses of the word blockchain, while virtually all experienced professionals agree that a blockchain is something to avoid. It's time to refresh the terms we use. Here are some ideas. Saying something is on the blockchain, in other words, your funds are secured on the blockchain, makes no sense. Having something on a block in a chain is almost never what you desire. What you want is for people to agree that global state changed. Funds are yours by consensus. For similar reasons, on-chain and off-chain are terms that put emphasis on hardly relevant technical details. Better options are polluting transactions, they produce more chain and more waste, and clean transactions. They do not create more global waste. Saying the Bitcoin blockchain and the Ethereum blockchain is also counterintuitive, unless you specifically are referring to the undesirable waste that's produced when transferring Bitcoins or running the EVM. Consider the Bitcoin network instead. Using the terms correctly can reduce confusion and help everyone focus on our common goal: minimizing our global chain footprint to ensure the continued health of the Bitcoin asset. End quote. It was a 6-tweet thread. That was just a fascinating way to think about it, is that the blockchain really is undesirable. It's just that we don't know any other way right now to 100% prove the validity and the verification of all of the coins without a history back to its creation, so that we know that never in the life of that Bitcoin have the consensus rules been violated or altered or changed arbitrarily in any way. And the blockchain is something that we would love to do without if we could get that some other way, but it is just waste. It is the product of how we get finality, which would lead to believe that the body of Bitcoin that is growing is the nodes. It is the constant expansion of the Bitcoin network, all of the participants, and that the nodes themselves are the cells rather than the blocks of the blockchain building Bitcoin. It's the nodes and the miners. It's everybody participating in the organism. You think about it, blocks are basically dead weight. They don't move or change. Old blocks are never altered. They aren't part of the process of the Bitcoin system. Everything that is changing is just at the head of Bitcoin. Everything that is live right now is the Bitcoin organism. And in that way, we can lose half of the cells. We could lose half of the miners, half of the nodes. We could have a huge catastrophe that Bitcoin would rebuild itself, just like if you cut, you know, half of a fungi or a mushroom mass, whatever you call it, in half, the other half would continue to grow and move from there. And just like cells in a human body, they are all part of an active process. Cells aren't stagnant. They all operate. They all do things. They all perform a function. So the body would be all of the software, all of the hardware, the networks, the people behind that hardware and networks that are kind of like the white blood cells or the enforcers and protectors of the genetic code. It's amazing how many roles you can start to break apart here when you're talking about this thing as a living organism. But this is, I've not been able to get this out of my head since I read this the other day. This is just such a great idea on how to illustrate what the blockchain is. And I think this is actually a really, really good point, that the blockchain is just kind of the, if it weren't necessary, we wouldn't want it. You know, like it's just an unfortunate requirement to reach the end goal, which is transaction finality and provable objective consensus on what the current state of the Bitcoin organism, the network, actually is. So that is actually something that has gotten me thinking a lot about that. And, you know, what the hell in that context is the Lightning Network and, you know, these layer two solutions that are building out from it. Because, you know, Bitcoin is a really fascinating thing, and it is definitely to be observed and studied, because I think it's going to expand in ways that we wouldn't expect, and it's going to change its characteristics in a lot of different ways as well. I don't think anybody really has, just like the internet, you know, we could always extrapolate, we could always guess as to what the internet may have looked like in, you know, 10 or 20 years when we're talking about back in the early 90s or something, but nobody really knows. Like, the internet is a thing unto itself because it is a cooperation among millions and millions of people, and Bitcoin is that same way, is that all of these entities that get sucked into it, the gravity of Bitcoin's system and concept, and then the economic incentives, like all of these things pull people in, and then they cooperate and work together to expand it, to fix it, to make it better, to make it less reliant on the blockchain, to make it more secure and easily verifiable. Like, all of these things are such crucial things to crucial parts of the entire system, and we just don't have any idea. It's going to be the culmination of so many different people's ideas. Like, new stuff is dropping all the time. Like, state chains are a fascinating concept that are barely, you know, a month or two old. And it could literally, if it worked, and it turns out to be, which, I mean, it works theoretically. It's not a very complicated system. But if it, you know, found massive adoption, the idea of how to use and exchange Bitcoin would change drastically. And it's just a fascinating, that could happen tenfold. You know, that could happen again and again and again. And everything that we think of as a Bitcoin transaction right now could turn into something totally different. And what I have come to think of, and I still think of, mostly because of the Lightning Network, again, a Lightning Network may not turn out to be as great or as powerful of a tool as many of us think it will. And if that's the case, well, then this idea of the future of Bitcoin transactions, I think there has to be some variation on this. There will be a degree of truth to this regardless. You know, it could not be quite like I imagine it, but I kind of see transactions now on the Bitcoin blockchain as what will be used to create financial networks, is that every transaction will be some form of a fully reserved, like, backed contract, like the Lightning Network, that creates liquidity for a new layer, that it traps value into a new network connection. So just like TCP/IP gets you to connect to the next computer and then the next computer, and you establish connections and then you route through those connections. Well, I think that's what I think Bitcoin transactions will be, is that the base layer is the discovery of digital scarcity, and it will be used to create digital commerce. But it won't be with base layer transactions, because the more transactions we put on the base layer, the more difficult it is to prove any degree of scarcity whatsoever. In fact, it becomes completely meaningless if nobody is actually validating, if nobody is checking or auditing the system. So the scarcity is gone. If we're using gigabyte blocks, scarcity is gone. No, all of it is completely meaningless. You have no guarantee of anything. You're just trusting somebody else. Another thing he points out in this piece that I think is critically important, and I agree with him that it's the most, it's the biggest risk to Bitcoin right now, is privacy. That if there is no fungibility in the coins, which is why so many of the developers and the community, so much of the community, is in fact focused on this problem right now, and why I think Lightning is important, even if it only gets a 5x or a 10x scaling, because of the transaction privacy and the inability to know exactly what address the payment is coming from. And that was really the cypherpunk dream, was to have completely anonymous, untraceable payments, that where of the destination and the origination were, you could not connect the two. And that's one of the powerful things about Lightning. In fact, that's one of the top concerns with Lightning, in my opinion. And privacy is still not completely there. There's still tons of data being leaked. And I would like to see more and more of the private channels, which we have seen, like a lot of the major nodes and services and stuff are now opening almost unanimously private channels, which is funny because it actually makes it look like Lightning is not being used. And maybe the network has actually shrunk a little bit, because I know in my experience, my channels have shrunk. I opened probably like 24-ish channels or something like that when I first got on the Lightning network, and I have since basically closed all the ones that were offline or unreliable or something like that, down to like maybe 15 between my two devices, and I guess maybe 16, I guess, because my Breeze wallet has one channel with Breeze. But in doing so, you know, I look like I've had, you know, a 40% reduction in my quote unquote usage of Lightning Network, which is anything but the truth. Like, I've actually started using, I've used Lightning way, way more than I did 2 or 3 months ago. I've used it, I use it 10x as much as I did when I was opening all those channels and it looked like I was doing a lot. But then at the same time, you can't see on the network any of the private channels. So there's this kind of unfortunate trade-off with getting extra privacy on Lightning means that we also have no idea how many people are actually using it. And we can't really know how many users there are, how many channels they are, like what the actual liquidity is. Like, it's a very difficult, the more private it becomes, the more difficult it is to actually pull any of that data, any of the analytics from the network. But I hope we get a lot more privacy on the base layer. And I think that is actually a critical part of, I actually think keeping blocks small are really important in that endeavor, because it will force aggregation. It will basically force a degree of transaction compression, where the way you achieve privacy on the base layer is you aggregate transactions. You put your input in a mix with, you know, 100 other inputs going to 100 outputs. And even if the amounts aren't obfuscated, there's at least a minor degree of additional privacy. And most importantly is if you can aggregate those signatures with something like Schnorr, one of the developments is coming to, hopefully, fingers crossed, if we can actually get the soft fork to happen, coming to Bitcoin, that you can aggregate all the signatures so you have no idea if the same public key signed 50 of them or just signed one of them or signed all 100. You don't know. All of the transactions look completely ubiquitous. Like, there's no difference between a transaction with a multi-sig, a transaction with 10 participants versus 10 inputs from the same person. Like, it's all arbitrary. There's no... The signature basically looks exactly the same every time, that's a really powerful privacy mechanism. But I think that is one of the top concerns, in my opinion, way more than the block size, in fact. And I think we'll let Knut's final thoughts be the final thoughts of this piece, actually. And I think we'll just close this one here. I wish I had a little bit more time to go into the commentary for yesterday's episode, but I got a lot to do, and I still have to prepare for the debate happening later today. I want to at least get a little bit of refresh on some stuff. So, until then, don't forget to follow Knut Svanholm on Twitter. Obviously, continue to link and have all the stuff available in the show notes and in the Twitter post. So that you can see that. If you want to get your hard copy of this book, which I actually think I'm going to buy myself one, just so I can have this around and maybe give it to somebody at some point, you can do that on Amazon, and I will have the Amazon link to it. It's not a very expensive book, and it's definitely a good one to have or to share with somebody who's interested in getting into Bitcoin. So also, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at TheCryptoEconomy if you have not, and subscribe to the show. That is the Crypto Economy Podcast with Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Thank you guys so much for listening to the unabridged audio and discussion of Sovereignty Through Mathematics by Knut Svanholm, and thank you for being listeners of the show. And I've realized that I've had a couple, like two or three patrons recently that I don't think I ever actually thanked on the show. So thank you to those guys, everybody who's become a patron and joined us in the Crypto Economy Crew Telegram. Thank you. One thing that I've been a little bit surprised by is what a wonderful resource it is to have a community of people who like want to support the show, and not just like they'll do work for me, but to share ideas and to like give me feedback on the episodes, and you know, talk about like works that they're interested in, and you know, push back on my ideas. You know, we actually, you know, tussle with little debates and conversations and stuff in the Telegram, and it's a really, really great resource to have, and I didn't expect it to be as useful. I thought it was just going to be fun, but it's actually been a wonderful and very useful tool for me. So I appreciate it 1,000 different ways. And if you want to support this show, if you want to turn all of the best written content in Bitcoin into the audio version it deserves, you can become a patron yourself and get access to the Crypto Economy Crew Telegram at patreon.com/thecryptoeconomy. As little as $1 a month will get you into the Telegram crew and chat with all the awesome people we've got in there. And of course, if you can't do that, you can always share this show out. Tell two people who are interested or curious about Bitcoin, or who are already in Bitcoin and just don't know about the podcast, don't know that they can get all of the best articles and even full books read to them and discussed aloud on a podcast that is practically daily when I can manage it. And that would be a huge, huge help. Thank you so much to everyone who has and does and continues to follow and listen. This has been a crazy ride, and I super appreciate it. And lastly, do not forget for a huge thank you to Knut Svanholm for making this available to us. All right, I love you guys. I'm out. And until next time, I am Guy Swan. Take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.